Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Eastern European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Book Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Marko Pulery, author of Ukrainian, Russophone, Other Russian, Hybrid Identities and Narratives in Post-Soviet Culture and Politics, published in 2020. Marko Pulery is research fellow in post-Soviet studies and adjunct professor of history of Eastern Europe, nation building and protection of minorities at the University of Bologna. His research interests include contemporary Russian and Ukrainian sociocultural developments and nation building in the post-Soviet area. His latest book is Ukrainian, Russophone, Other Russian, Hybrid Identities and Narratives in Post-Soviet Culture and Politics. He has written several articles on the Ukrainian, Russian cultural and social history. From 2015 to 2017, he has been among the coordinators of the international research project entitled Russia and China in the Global World, State and Society Between Internal Dynamics and External Projections. Hello, Marko.
Hello, Natalia.
Thank you so much for joining me today. And I am really looking forward to the discussion of your book. The topic that you cover in your recent book is complex and multi-layered. And I think the title of the book shows this as well. Ukrainian, Russophone, Other Russian, Hybrid Identities and Narratives in Post-Soviet and Culture and Politics. So there are a lot of aspects to consider, and there are a lot of histories involved in the issues that you include in this publication. The language question, which doesn't seem to leave Ukraine anytime soon. The identity question, which still in many cases in Ukraine is closely associated with what language one speaks. Soviet and post-Soviet cultural and political conditions, which heavily influenced the first decades of independent Ukraine, which still seem to define it and at least produce some influences today. So in a word, it's a real challenge to consider all these aspects in a coherent way, as they create entanglements that are rather difficult to unravel. How did you situate yourself in these entangled clusters of historical and cultural narratives?
Okay. First of all, I would like to thank you for your interest in my research, Natalia. I'm very glad to be here today and to discuss today with you about my research. I believe that my book is quite open to different readings and perspectives. That it comes especially from my background in Russian and Ukrainian studies, and so mainly in literature studies, that then brought me also to get interested in global political dynamics in Ukraine and in the broader post-Soviet region. I believe that the very title of the book is quite telling. So, as you said, Ukrainian, Russophone, other Russians. So I tried this way to pose a different research question than the one that maybe was already posed in other studies, in other books published throughout the latest years, if we just think about the whole research that was produced in the US, in Canada, in Europe, about the developments in post-Maidan Ukraine, also in a kind of a long-term perspective about what happened in Ukraine in the post-Soviet era. I believe that trying also to intersect a kind of a view on the developments in literature in the broader cultural field in Ukraine with the developments in politics and so in the political discourse, maybe we could find some new questions, research questions to think about, but also some potential new answers that can be found in the cultural field of Ukraine. So my idea was exactly to deconstruct these categories such as Ukrainian, Russian, and Russophone as a kind of a static categories or static and essentialized entities. Trying also to focus on the idea of Russophonia or of Russophone identities and Russophone subjectivities as hybrid subjectivities. Because this way I tried to deconstruct also the idea of Russian or Russianness as a kind of a unified array of perspectives and identities, trying also to look at the Russian language as a global language, as a world language, so in a way as a language that can be also that can also have kind of different standards, different developments worldwide. And this was maybe the starting point to look at the current developments in Ukraine and to look at how these kind of identities and categories such as Russophone, Russian, and Ukrainian are structured through the use of narratives. Narratives that can be implemented in both the political field by political actors, but also in the cultural field by intellectuals while looking at the current developments in the country.
Mm-hmm. So the language question, which primarily focuses on what language one speaks, Ukrainian and Russian in this case, is one of those issues that stir emotions not only on the personal level, but also on the public, first and foremost, political level. When Ukraine approaches another round of political elections, the language issue is brought to the very surface of political debates again and again. And it goes without saying that this issue has been highly politicized. What's your take on the language concern in Ukraine? How did you approach it in your research?
So that's a very important question in Ukraine, but not only in Ukraine, of course. I believe that the main question we should pose ourselves is to reflect around the idea of who owns a language. We usually think about a national language or a state language as a kind of product that is owned by the state and not by the speakers. And that's something that maybe we should try to overcome also while looking at the Ukrainian cultural field, where, for example, it is possible, and as the Maidan Revolution also showed us, to speak Russian, but to feel closer to the Ukrainian state. So in a way to create this kind of contradiction between the idea of state and the idea of language. That's, of course, the starting point also to understand how different Russophone identities and so different identities were created by people who speak Russian in Ukraine and cannot be connected to the idea of a link to the Russian state. And I believe this is something very important that reveals more than a political crisis, as it was in a way discussed in the aftermath of the Maidan Revolution, the contested annexation of Crimea to Russia and the war in Donbass, in the broader public debate. So more than focusing on a political crisis, we should focus more on a kind of epistemological crisis. And that's what I try to analyze in my book. So I believe that more than discussing about the developments of the struggle, of the so-called struggle that was constructed in the Russian media mostly between Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians and Russian-speaking Ukrainians and Russians in the country, we should more discuss about the way in which these categories were structured in the political debate since the collapse of the Soviet Union, where we saw this wide and this large group of people that we could define as Russian speakers that were still trying to construct, to build a new identity that could go beyond these kinds of narratives that were constructed by the state. That's also why I tried to focus mostly on literature, because literature can also be described as a kind of a speech act, and so also as a way as an attempt to construct and to create a kind of self-awareness of the own identity and of the own place in the new world that was created in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
I would like to move to that notion that you put in the title of your book, Hybrid Identities. So Ukraine is a multinational, and it's safe to say, multilingual country. And more often than not, when one speaks about bilingualism in Ukraine, it's implied that the conversation in the first place will be about Russian and Ukrainian. However, this implication leaves behind, for example, Polish and Hungarian. In your book, you identify identities that are formed in a Ukrainian-Russian language environment as hybrid. Would you elaborate a little bit on hybrid identities in Ukraine, and what does this understanding of Ukraine and Ukrainians involve?
Mm-hmm. So I tried to select some concepts and some tools from postcolonial studies because I believe they could be useful also to look at the current developments in Ukraine. There was a great debate about the potential application of postcolonial studies to the post-Soviet world that started even in the 90s. And I believe that postcolonial studies can actually be helpful in post-Soviet studies when we try to grasp some concepts and to take some concepts and some theories that were elaborated for the study of the third world, because they can tell us something about this kind of overlap between different languages, traditions, and the attempt to create a unifying narrative that can, in a way, bring together all the different features of the new post-Soviet national fields. So I believe that a hybridity can be a useful tool for understanding the contemporary developments in Ukrainian culture, because it gives us the possibility exactly to go beyond those kinds of narratives that were created and were inherited by Ukraine from imperial and Soviet times. Hybridity was a kind of identity that maybe was also experienced by the other cultural actors in the history of Ukraine. We can just think about the most outstanding example, the example of Nikolai Gogol or Nikola Gogol, that in a way suggests us that this kind of struggle between the two souls of Gogol is still experienced by contemporary Ukrainians. But maybe this hybridity was also in a way brought again to center stage in the aftermath of Euromaidan, where we saw a lot of Russian speakers that were there in the main square of Kiev, in the Square of Freedom, trying to defend their own rights and to fight next to Ukrainian speakers for a new idea of Ukraine. It is hybridity can also help us understand how the idea of contemporary Ukraine is still in a state of formation, because different actors are in a way joining the debate around the shape of the Ukrainian nation, the shape of the new Ukrainian affiliation to the Ukrainian state, and we see how the Maidan revolution brought exactly this question to center stage. The problem is comes again from the the continuation of this refusal of hybridity as a kind of threat to the Ukrainian state that comes, of course, from the historical experience of Ukrainians that most of all experienced a kind of hybridity, we could say, as a forced experience that was brought by the imperial and Soviet rule. If we just think about the bans on Ukrainian language that were issued in imperial times, or the struggle between the two cultures that was developed in Soviet times. Nowadays, we saw that even without any political support, at least in the Ukrainian state, from the Ukrainian state and Ukrainian political actors to the Russian language products, Russian language works, literary works, were created by Ukrainians for Ukrainians in the Ukrainian state. These products and this kind of, cultural market was then appropriated by the Russian state as Russian. This is something that we should always take into account while thinking about the role of the contested role of Russian language and Russian culture in Ukraine, because we see that something is constantly produced in Russian in the cultural field of Ukraine, but is not institutionalized in Ukraine, but is mostly appropriated by the Russian state. And I guess this is also kind of a chance that is lost by the Ukrainian state actors while thinking about the possibility to create a kind of independent Ukrainian-Russian speaking cultural field. And maybe this is one of the main questions that I try to pose in my book while thinking about informal and formal connections between Ukrainian-speaking and Russian-speaking cultural actors that didn't have a proper platform to develop from that could be offered and could be created by the state itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting what you're describing right now. And to some extent, this kind of the lack of institutionalization of literature, which is written in Russian in Ukraine, is connected to some extent to the contemporary events. However, we can also say that it was quite true for the 90s as well. So, the reason I'm bringing this up is that, I just share my personal memory about reading Gogol for the first time. It was a very strange feeling, I would say, because I was reading them. I was reading his works when I was taking a high school course in Russian literature. However, it was those Ukrainian stories that he first published. And it was a very weird sense when you are reading a Russian writer, the way he was presented to us, but you realize that you can connect with him more than, for example, with other Russian writers. And he situates you in Ukraine, and he guides you through those Ukrainian, let's say, landscapes and cultural environments. So it was quite a... quite a strange feeling, I would say. Well, today, as far as I know, Gogol is taught in both courses, world literature, and I'm not quite sure about Ukraine, and I think Ukrainian literature as well for some lower school levels, if I'm not mistaken, but I can be wrong there. So, in other words, there is this kind of gesture to somehow situate at least Gogol in two spaces, or maybe not just in two spaces, because Gogol is more than two spaces. It's always like all-encompassing scope. So I would like you to comment on this kind of strange attitude, I would say, to literature written in Russian, not only today, because, well, I can rationalize more what's going today than what was going on in the 90s. So sometimes I think that some opportunities to establish, for example, Russian in Ukraine as our language, for example, because you just mentioned that it's the question who owns the language, were dismissed. Not just dismissed, but maybe disregarded and overlooked, because the process, which is quite important not only for Ukraine but in Russia today, means that Russian is only for the Russian Federation. We do have our language policies. However, these language policies are also shaped by our neighbors.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I definitely agree with you. And I guess this is a question that strictly depends on the institutionalization of literary canons, not only in the post-Soviet region, but even worldwide. I was thinking while listening to your insights, I was thinking about the situation in the academic field in Italy. For example, when I tried to study these phenomena, so Russian speaking, Russian language literature in Ukraine, I had a lot of difficulties also to find a kind of common field and common ground for conversation with experts in Russian studies, which is of course the main field of study in Italy, and to broaden their view of this field as also including literary phenomena emerging in the whole post-Soviet region, in Ukraine, in Kazakhstan, or in Estonia, for example. I guess this is a very important issue to be answered in both the academic field and in the public debate. I'm thinking about, and I mentioned this event in the introduction to my book while talking about Svetlana Alexievich, which in a way brought to center stage of the public debate the issue around their identity. Because as far as we had the chance to read in the newspapers in the Russian Federation, in Ukraine, or in Belarus, we saw how different perspectives and different processes of appropriation or rejection of this author were in a way enacted and implemented. I guess this is also an issue that involves the international recognition of this phenomena as belonging to a specific national, we could say, cultural field. I am thinking about the position of Andrei Kurkov in the contemporaneity. For example, we know that Kurkov was harshly criticized in Ukraine for adopting Russian language in his works, while in the West is the most famous author, Ukrainian author, and the most translated authors in the West, and not only in the West. And we see how this process of recognition abroad brought him to be recognized even in Ukraine itself. So that's why I believe that to discuss this kind of issue, we should always think not only about politics, but also about the different direction that can be undertaken by the cultural market, the global cultural market worldwide. I had also the chance maybe to get acquainted with Russian-speaking, Ukrainian Russian-speaking authors in the West before then getting acquainted with them in Ukraine itself. I remember my first experiences in Ukraine looking for books written by Russian-speaking authors, this kind of cast brought me to Petrivka, so to the black market. That was the only way to find these books, because they couldn't be distributed in the internal literary market in Ukraine, or in a way it was also difficult to find them in the Ukrainian literary market. Even in the post-Maidan times, I remember also looking for some books authored by Vladimir Rafienko, older books that were previously published by Russian publishers. I could find them only in Knihatnya Ye, in Lviv, in a devoted show, in a shop devoted to foreign literature, or to it happened to me only once, or to Russian Russiskomovna literatura Ukraini. So it was very, very interesting to see how even this process of canonization, we could say, of this phenomenon is still in a state of formation. Not only the idea of creating a new potential Russophone identity, Ukrainian Russophone identity, but also a connection between this process and the process concerning literature.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Mm-hmm. I would like to go back to that notion of hybrid identities and to Gogol, of course, again. And in your book, if I'm not mistaken, you mentioned that he's probably one of the first literary contested figures in Ukrainian literature, or the father of literary contested identities in Ukrainian literature. Are hybrid identities different depending on the time period when we talk about them? For example, is a hybrid identity of Gogol will differ from Kurkov's hybrid identity, or from any? Maybe you can comment a little bit on other examples that you discuss in your book.
So that's of course an important question to pose. And I believe that, my answer would be yes, of course. Hybrid identities and also hybridity, in order to be a kind of, we could say, effective category for analysis of these literary and political phenomena, should be defined differently according to the different historical periods that we are analyzing. I believe that contemporary hybridity is different, and for example, the contemporary hybridity of Vladimir Rafienko, a Russian language writer from Donetsk, is different from the hybridity experienced from another contemporary Russian language author from Kiev, such as Alexei Nikitin. And it is, of course, different also from the hybridity experienced by Nikolai Vasilievich Gogol. So, in a way, we should understand hybridity as a different way to approach this kind of cultural experiences and identities created by individuals in Ukraine as being in contact with different cultural, we could say, and life experiences, first of all. So everyday use of a language or everyday contact with different cultural products, we could say, and also hybridity as depending on the way these kinds of static narratives that we tried to describe at the beginning of our conversation, such as the ones describing Russianness, Ukrainianness, and Ruskoyazychnost, so we could say the Russian-speaking identity as static identities. So hybridity is a way exactly to face, to overcome this kind of static nature of structuring the own identity. And I believe reading, for example, or thinking about the experience of Vladimir Rafienko moving from Donetsk to Kiev in 2014 and starting writing in Ukrainian, being translated from Russian into Ukrainian for the broader Ukrainian readership, of course, can tell us that the hybridity is also able to readapt to different contexts, to different political constraints, and to change throughout the life experience of the different cultural actors that can be described under the label of hybridity. Of course, it is an analytical tool to describe these experiences. We could term it also differently. We could adopt also different categories to describe this kind of multiplicity of identities and of potential paths of development. But I believe that a hybridity is also an important category for Ukraine, because it was also one of the first terms that was used in the aftermath of the, when widely used in the aftermath of the political events that followed Euromaidan, even in the academic debate. It was quite clear that something new was there to happen, something new was there to be created. And then, unfortunately, this novelty was not developed more, or was just forgotten in the first political developments of post-Maidan Ukraine. We could think about the what happened in under the presidency of Petro Poroshenko, what is happening now. We see that still the language debate as structured in the post-Soviet times is still there and can be back to center stage of the political debate without adding anything new to this debate, but only being able to divide Ukrainians more than creating something that can unify Ukrainians. And that's something that is really disappointing to external observers, or to me as an outsider, of course, in Ukrainian affairs, because I believe that maybe the institutionalization of Ukrainian-Russian could be of help in this field. Of course, there is always the kind of threat coming from the Russian state, and we can mention the infamous Russian word project, or in a way idea, that is promoted by the Russian Federation, that could reappropriate this kind of Ukrainian-Russian cultural field. But of course, I guess that political actors in Ukraine should maybe have a kind of courage to take some important positions that could bring to something new, more than bring back to something that was already experienced by, and tragically experienced by, Ukrainian throughout the post-Soviet years.
Mm-hmm. So, and your expert opinion on the possibility to institutionalize hybrid identity, so to speak, through school curriculum. Do you think that it's worth considering this kind of option at the current political level, in the current political situation?
That's, of course, a difficult question to answer. In my view, it would be worth to think about that. Maybe the current political situation in wartime, of course, doesn't help even the contemporary political actors and political administration of Ukraine to take some important decisions for the country. And maybe when the war, we all hope, will be over, some potential decisions should be also helpful for the reconciliation process. For example, if this reconciliation process has to happen, because we all hope that this one day we will see reconciliation between East Ukraine and the Donbass, the uncontrolled territories of Donbass, and the whole Ukraine will be there to happen. But of course, we don't know what will happen next. But of course, I guess that this kind of approach to the identity issue and language issue, focusing more on civic attributes of Ukrainian identity and less to the kind of nationalizing issues, taking into account cultural issues, could be, of course, of help to Ukraine and to the future, the political future of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And about Ukraine, I guess that's also something that should be discussed also in other parts of the post-Soviet world, while thinking about the role of Russian speakers and Russian and Russians.
So this situation is not quite unique for Ukraine and hybrid identities. This issue is not that unique just for Ukraine.
Yes, I believe so. I think so. And that's also why one of the reasons, because in the acknowledgments to my book, I wanted to mention the creation of this new platform for researchers and authors focusing on Russian language, literary and not only literary cultural phenomena emerging in the post-Soviet region, but also worldwide, to gather together and to discuss about this issue and to create also a new kind of approach to this. I guess this is something that especially people in the academia, scholars, should focus more and more about, because this is the issue, I would say, in the region. Also to understand that something new was created in the last 30 years in the aftermath of the post-Soviet of the Soviet collapse, and we should analyze exactly how these social developments in the country, and of course Russian language identities or Russian language narratives are among the most important social developments in the region, and how these phenomena should be primarily under our focus mm-hmm. while looking at these countries.
You just mentioned that Ukraine gained its independence almost 30 years ago, but still we have this ongoing issue with the language. Why?
Boy, I guess this is of course it is difficult to explain. I always try to explain it, for example, to my students or to just friends who are not in Ukrainian studies or Russian studies. I guess this is of course the product of the political debate that emerged in the aftermath of Ukrainian independence in 1991. And also the way that political field in Ukraine was structured exactly around this issue, around the language issue. And so it is difficult to think about the political future of Ukraine without thinking about the role that can be played by the state language. It is, of course, a product of the way the political debate was structured in the 19th century and in the 20th century. So where the political debate was mostly built in the literary and cultural debate. And so language was there to assume, to have a primary role for understanding and for stressing the difference between the Ukrainian national identity from the Russian one, for example, but not only, just let's think about the Ukrainian-Polish relations too. Even today, I believe we should always think about the language issue as a political structured, historically structured, and as also determined, of course, by the role and the post-imperial, we could say, a legacy of the Russian Federation and the Russian position in the regional arena, at least. And so the way this kind of aspect is exploited by political actors in the Russian Federation, also to maintain their own influence in the other countries in the post-Soviet region, it is of course a matter of economic power, because the potential for the creation of an independent cultural market or media sphere in Ukraine is, of course, depending from the economic potential of the country. And as I tried also to explain in my book, this also depended on the way the cultural market, the national cultural market, was restructured in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we see how, for example, in Ukraine, it is even difficult to find a publication or a book copy in territories which are not Kiev or Lviv as the cultural capitals, we could say, of the country. This is, of course, a problem. In whereas we think that in those in other regions we could mostly find cultural products in Russian, which are of course which have a broader and wider distribution than the cultural products in Ukraine. In Ukrainian, of course, this is something that is changing in the aftermath of Maidan Revolution, and hopefully the situation will be different in 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask you this question about those cases when, for different reasons, speakers decide to stop speaking Russian. And the cases like that were quite numerous after the events of 2014. And I would like to connect this episode with your previous thought about hybrid identities as some sign of identities which are in the process of formation. So is there any connection, or what does this act of dropping one of your languages, for example, may signal to you? And how it reflects, for example, the existence of hybrid identities? Does that mean that hybrid identity changes its form, or it transforms into something different, or it's just a different manifestation?
I believe that this is, of course, an aspect that we should take into account, and this is something that is very telling of the way hybridity is able to change its form throughout life experience and according to the different developments in the surrounding environment, we could say, politically and culturally. I see that hybridity in the Ukrainian context is really going around the potential triadic nexus, we could say, between being Ukrainians, being Russian, and being Russophone or Ukrainophone, and so on, the different meanings that can be applied to these categories. I see that as most of the sociological research showed us, more and more people decided to switch to Ukrainian and to speak Ukrainian, and so to stop speaking Russian. But it is not so much as expected, we could say. So most people decided to go on speaking Russian, but still maintaining and keeping an identification with the Ukrainian state. So, of course, something has changed after the Euromaidan revolution. But in another way, the complete, we could say, switching to Ukrainian and the refusal of Russian, in my view, or at least as a, for what is happening in the Ukrainian field, is also a kind of, we could say, a loss for the Ukrainian cultural arena. Because a lot of writers, for example, in the cultural field, have decided not to write in Russian, as far as this as the war with Russia is going on, so identifying Russian as the enemy's language. This is, in my view, we should see, of course, how this kind of approach will develop in the forthcoming years, because we should see if this approach will be maintained by these people, or if hybridity will be these writers to switch again to Russia. But of course, I guess that this also depends on the way the Ukrainian Russian-speaking cultural arena was not institutionalized. And so these people believed that it was worth switching to Ukrainian in order to show the connection with the their connection with the Ukrainian state, because Russian was not able enough, or was a kind of a potential marker of their own position as enemies of the Ukrainian state. And I guess this is of course something that we should think about. I mentioned in the book an interview and some reflections offered by Iakiva, a contemporary Ukrainian Russian speaking author from Donetsk, who moved to Kiev in the aftermath of the beginning of the war in Donbass, who identifies herself as the as belonging to the potential last generation of Russian speaking poets in the country. I guess this is something quite telling, because I guess that missing this kind of room for hybridity can also be a kind of loss for the multiplicity, heterogeneity of the Ukrainian cultural scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in your book, you also mentioned another aspect when you talk about why some writers decided to stop writing in Russian. And one of those aspects is connected with how they are read and how they are understood in Russia, for example, because the writers from Ukraine who write in Russian are considered as writers from the periphery or provincial writers, and to some extent it can be a factor why some writers decided to stop focusing on producing some material in Russian. And but again, they have to find their space, so to speak, their room in Ukraine. And there are other processes which are taking place in Ukraine which are not quite favorable for those writers to keep writing in Russian. So I guess my comment is about, again, this two-way interaction between not only Ukraine and Russia, but between any other state where Russian is spoken, that it is always perceived through the rhetoric of the Russian Federation that emphasizes the fact that Russian is first and foremost the language of the Russian Federation, and in any other area, it will be seen as a lower level, probably, in terms of how that language is spoken. And it causes some stigma, and it causes some, well, critical remarks, which are probably not very flattering, I'll put it this way. However, as you do mention in your book, there are a lot of writers who were born in Ukraine and who started writing in Russian, and they were quite successful in Russia. They received awards, and their works were published by prestigious venues.
I guess this is, of course, one of the most interesting points, and it also depends on the way the individual writer approaches this kind of issue. I had the chance, for example, and there are a lot of studies about the situation in Latvia, where Russian-speaking media, we can just think about Medusa as one of the most famous Russian-speaking media, but especially Russian-speaking cultural actors as the literary group Orbita can show us create and work exactly on this kind of interaction between Latvian and Russian, for example, so translating their own works in both languages, and so creating also some new processes and going on and developing in different languages. I believe that this kind of perception of the Russian language products produced outside of the Russian Federation as we could say a low culture. So as belonging to low culture is of course a kind of a heritage of the Soviet system and the imperial one we just mentioned, for example, the case of Nikolai Gogol, and so also the way he perceived this kind of inferiority in the St. Petersburg scene, while using also and adopting a kind of specific kind of Russian in his own works, also for literary intentions and literary reasons. I see that throughout these 30 years, I would say there is a more awareness about the possibility to use Russian differently, at least from below. So what is really missing in most cases is the standardization from the top, and so the kind of justification or answer that can be found from the top to the presence of a different realm of culture in Russian language in different countries in the region. And I believe that is something that will come, will have a kind of result in the upcoming years, because it's something that it's one of the most important results of the social developments in the latest 30 years. I happen to read also different works so authored by scholars in the field who experience this kind of multiple belonging to different cultural traditions. So being Russian speakers, for example, being born in Georgia, moving to another state in the West and starting writing about contemporary issues, and also asking themselves who they are. And so I guess this is something that will be more and more under the focus of different studies and will bring one day maybe and hopefully to a kind of institutionalization of state varieties of Russian worldwide. Because this is a process that was experienced by other languages such as the German, English, and Spanish. And of course, maybe one day will come also for Russian language.
Let's hope for that day to come soon. And I would like to support your statement on the importance of awareness. Probably they should be more aware of the importance of these issues, and it's not just about what language you speak or what language you choose to speak. I had an opportunity to attend one of the talks by Oksana Zabushko. It was it was online, and she said that there is a lot of silence in Ukrainian culture, that the Ukrainians do not tend to speak a lot, and her comment was about traumas that the Ukrainians carry. And I would say that, of course, there are a lot of traumatic experiences in Ukraine, but I think that the language question can also be one of those traumatic experiences, especially today, especially after 2014, but not only especially 2014, but during the Sovietization, during Ukrainization as well, and Russification of Ukraine during the first years of the Soviet Union. I think that it's quite important to be aware of these tendencies, of these processes, and it's quite important to speak about these tragedies and about these traumas. So I would like to thank you for your book and for your research and for initiating this conversation about these topics, which are very sensitive and sometimes topics are politicized. However, they are politicized for manipulative purposes. But I think, as your book proves, it's worth talking about it, and it's, I would say, high time for, to start and to start speaking about these issues, which actually do shape the contemporary Ukrainian identity. Thank you so much, Marco, for your book and for this conversation. Today I spoke with Marco Pulery, author of Ukrainian, Russophone, Other Russian, Hybrid Identities and Narratives in Post-Soviet Culture and Politics, published by Peter Lang in 2020. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.